From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Coming up later on the show, we're visiting with local leaders and organizers about how La Crosse's annual Martin Luther King celebration has had to adapt due to COVID restrictions. First up, the Reverend Dr. William Barber is the president of Repairers of the Breach. He's co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. He's pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina. And he's the keynote speaker at this year's Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration here in La Crosse, which has been moved online this year due to COVID. Reverend Barber spoke with our own Hope Kerwin.
As you prepare for your Martin Luther King Day remarks, what strikes you from his life and his work that is most relevant in light of today's trials?
Well, first of all, I think the entire life of Martin Luther King and his legacy continues to speak to us in profound ways, but particularly his last work, the Poor People's Campaign, and the last night that he was with us in Memphis. There were some words that he said that we need to hear today. I'll be talking about them. Most of the time people say it was, "I've been to the mountaintop and I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I might not get there with you, but we as a people will get there." They often focus on that, which was a refrain, a closing that he often shared. It was more profound because he got shot the next day and murdered. But before getting there, he was talking about Memphis, talking about poverty, talking about injustice. Here he was, a PhD in Memphis, standing with garbage collectors. And when he looked at the situation in America and the triune evils of poverty, racism, militarism, he said nothing would be more tragic than for us to stop at this point or for us to turn back at this point. And when I think about the fact that we literally today have 43% of this nation that still lives in poverty and low wealth, and since COVID, another 8 million people have been added, and we still have to deal with systemic racism in attitude, actions, policies, and personality. And even in Wisconsin, when I look at the fact that 40% of people in Wisconsin are poor and low wealth. 1.5 million of them are white. 700,000 are black or people of color. Even in Wisconsin, 400,000 people without health care, and over a million people in Wisconsin that work every day for less than a living wage. Think about that, less than a living wage. And they were like that before COVID hit, and it's only gotten worse. We must address systemic racism and policy, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy, and the false moral narrative of religious nationalism. And nothing would be more tragic than for us to turn back at this point.
You have been a part of the modern reincarnation of Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign. I wonder if you could talk about why this work is so important to you personally.
Well, I've been a part of it. I would also like for the historical record to say that it was the welfare rights workers, many of them that came out of the North, that pushed Dr. King to engage the Poor People's Campaign. It was Latinos like Cesar Chavez, and it was Native Americans, and it was white people working in Appalachia along with black people from Mississippi and Alabama. So we often say it was his Poor People's Campaign, but really, when Dr. King laid out the three evils of racism, poverty, and militarism, 1 year exact to his murder and assassination at Riverside Church, and talked about a time to break silence, you know, many of his staff walked away from him. Many of the civil rights organizations passed resolutions against his stance. 100-some-odd newspapers walked away from him. And when he launched the Poor People's Campaign in December of that year, December 4th, it was actually a fusion coalition of many, many people who had not traditionally been together. And we need to remember that. And today, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, my co-chair is Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris. We've got 43 state coordinating committees, one right there in Wisconsin, across this country, made up of all races of people, classes, genders, sexualities, that have come together to say we can no longer allow poverty and the interlocking injustices to exist as they are. You know, I grew up in a very poor county the congressional district that I'm in is the 13th or 14th poorest congressional district in the country. You know, I grew up, my father went back home and lived and worked among the poor. And I know what poverty is. I know what it was experienced. Even though my parents were educated, they came back to the South. They still didn't have certain rights protected in the 1960s. And, you know, my father suffered health problems. He was a former a member of the Navy, and he in the 40s, and he suffered health problems. And so I know what it's like. I grew up around it. I grew up on the farm. I grew up working as a farm hand. And so it's very personal to me that I know that far too many communities from Appalachia to Alabama where people struggle with poverty, not because they're immoral, not because Republicans racialize it and say it's a part of that, you know, black folk and brown folk, and not because Democrats run from it and talk about the middle class and not the poor. There are people in poverty because too many of our policies don't establish justice, and they do not promote the general welfare of all people in this nation.
As we consider the legacy of Dr. King, I think some people in our predominantly white community here, you know, might think of racism, might think of the civil rights movement as something in the past, as something in Dr. King's time. And I just wonder how community members can talk to each other openly about race and privilege and prejudice in the present, in the now.
Well, first of all, civil rights is an ever-going, ever-vigilant fight, just like democracy is an ever-vigilant fight. You know, that's what election's about. That's what the freedom of speech and protest is all about. That's why we push and battle and fight for policy changes. This democracy is not easy, and there are those who often want to walk backwards. I mean, we talk about Trump, but even before Trump, since 2010, 26 states have passed voter suppression laws, including Wisconsin. When we talk about you know, this country, we saw a massive tax cut a few years ago for the wealthy, but then we've seen a fight to just make sure people had health care and had wages. Now, while black people are disproportionately affected, percentage-wise, the majority of poor folk and low-wealth people and people without health care are white. One of the ways we have to talk about race is, first of all, to talk about systemic racism, not just attitudes, but policies. The attitudes are often cover-ups for the policies. Ibram Kendi, in his book, Stamped from the Beginning, talks about racism is about policy. So we have to deal with systemic racism. But then we have to show how systemic racism is not just about black people. When you talk about systemic racism, I'll be talking about how it affects Latino people, how it affects indigenous people, and the policies that are rooted in systemic racism, but also the collateral damage toward white people. And what I mean by that is, take for instance racist voter suppression. That is targeted at black people, brown people, and indigenous people. That's what racist voter suppression is targeted. Things like poll tax photo IDs and gerrymandering. But we actually, when we come into communities and train on this, we put up a map and we show all the legislators in a state that benefited from voter suppression. And then we overlay that map with all of the legislators that vote against health care and vote against living wages. And what we find is, the very people that use race to get elected, racist voter suppression to get elected, once they get elected, they use the power they have in a way that hurts more white people in raw number than black people. That changes the conversation in the room because people began to understand that while racism, systemic racism, may be targeted at black, brown, and indigenous people, it ultimately undermines democracy. It's not just anti-black, it's anti-democracy.
You know, as we look at the events over the last year in our country and the conversations we're having about systemic racism, do you think a post-racial America is something that's possible? Or, you know, is that even the aim that we should be working towards?
No, it's not the aim what we should be working toward. What we should be working toward, and I would say whatever we see has happened the last year is deeply rooted. You know, it's not just Trump. It's a system. Trump benefited, for instance, what Neil Painter from New Jersey called. He said he's the iconography of a too often repeated American reality. We take steps forward, like the election of President Obama and the policies he pushed, and then we take many steps backwards. We've had at least two reconstructions in this country. The first one, 1865, after the Civil War to around the 1890s, it was overthrown by political trickery and violence and racism. Then we had a second reconstruction of 1954 to 1968. It was overthrown by death and murder and assassinations and a Southern strategy that was designed as by their own right, they called it positive, their own mouths, they said positive polarization, to divide the country along the issues of race and then to benefit from that division. That was the whole point of the Southern strategy. And that strategy was also played out in some northern places. You know, I'm familiar enough with Wisconsin to know about, Father Gropey and Milwaukee. And they often call Milwaukee the Selma of the South, of the North, excuse me. But when we look at this, these terms that people come up with are so puny: post-racial, left, right, conservative, centrist. What we really need is to say, why not let's do what we said in writing? That's what Dr. King said. America, you put some stuff in writing. You know, you said that your goal was to ensure domestic tranquility, and the way to do that is to establish justice, promote the general welfare, and provide for the common defense and equal protection under the law. Why not just measure all our policies by that standard and let that be the goal? Does this policy ensure domestic tranquility? Does it establish justice, not for half the people, but for all the people? Does it promote the general welfare, and does it provide equal protection under the law? We also claim to be, in many parts, a country of faith. We put hands on Bibles and holy books. When politicians and others are elected to office, they love to swear themselves in. Well, what's inside of those holy books? That the societies are strongest and best when they're rooted in justice and love and concern for the least of these, the poor and the vulnerable. When we lift from the bottom, the entire society is lifted. That's the wisdom of Dr. King. And you either do that and have community, or you have chaos. What we should be shooting for is the beloved community, the just community, the loving community, the community rooted in truth. And in order to do that, what we need not so much is a post-racial society, but a post-systemic racism society, a post-poverty society, a post-denial of healthcare society, a post-ecological devastation society, a post-war economy society, and a post religious nationalism society. We need to address these interlocking injustices all the way. Imagine if we had not had the level of poverty and denial of health care when we entered into COVID. The fissures, imagine if we hadn't had racial disparities in health care and income. It's the fissures of racism and the fissures of poverty, and then an inept, almost criminal response or a non-response in some ways by the White House and members of the Senate that has allowed this COVID to take such a hold in this society in a way that is greater than any other society in the world. And yet we all the time want to call ourselves the greatest society in the world. And yet look at where we are, because we've not addressed the fissures of racial disparity and economic injustice and inequality.
Reverend Barber, okay. Thank you for your time today.
God bless you. Look forward to being with you by video at the college.
That's Reverend Dr. William Barber with our Hope Kerwin. Hear Reverend Barber's keynote address Monday night at 7 during the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration. More information is at viterbo.edu or online on the Viterbo University Facebook page. Up next, we'll visit with local leaders and organizers about how La Crosse's annual MLK celebration has had to adapt due to COVID-19 restrictions. Remember, if you'd like to listen to Reverend Barber's interview again or to stream one of our previous shows on demand, you can find them all at our website. It's wpr.org/newsmakers. The show continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Bureau in La Crosse. Thank you so much for listening today. In our previous segment, you heard our interview with the Reverend Dr. William Barber. Thanks so much to Hope Kerwin for stepping in and giving us the assist on that interview with Reverend Barber and joining us today to continue our conversation about the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day of Service here in the La Crosse area. Our three guests joining me on the panel today, we have two guests from Viterbo University. Dr. Richard Kite is the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership, and Colin Burns-Gilbert is the director of Orientation and Engagement. And I thank both of them for joining us. Dr. Kite, Colin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ezra. I appreciate it.
We have Amanda Goodenough as well, who is the director of Campus Climate at UWL. We'll hear more about what that is as part of their diversity and inclusion efforts at UWL. And she is this year's Martin Luther King Leadership Award recipient. And that's all coming up. When I reference this year's leadership recipient, usually there would be a big to-do at Viterbo and the whole community would gather and these people would be honored. This year, it's all happening online as part of the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration. That's coming up on Monday at 7 p.m. and we'll give you more information on where you can see that. But first of all, Amanda, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So let's talk about the day itself coming up this Monday in La Crosse, the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration. Lots of different kinds of events going on as part of the celebration. But as I mentioned, the celebratory parts of it all moving online. So let's talk about some of those things that are still happening kind of in person and throughout the community. Colin, you're involved in the planning of some of those details as far as educational opportunities, service opportunities, a big part of Martin Luther King Day these days. Tell us about everything that's going to be going on this year on Martin Luther King Day in La Crosse.
What's not happening? I mean, it's we have a full boat. I think the morning is really kind of set aside for service and really to connect into the community. So I've been fortunate to work with some incredible nonprofits directly and ask them, you know, what burdens do you have that we can help take off your plate, right? Big, small, everything in between. And so we have almost 30 different projects coordinated, some on campus, some completely virtual, some in person with COVID safety guidelines in place, but space for over 200 of the Viterbo students and employees are all encouraged to join because most classes are canceled and really kind of prioritizing this day as a chance to live out that legacy of Dr. King and the messages that he stood for. So that morning is really going to kind of be the bulk of service and getting connected into the community, getting to build relationships with the nonprofits and between folks. And then throughout the rest of the day, there's going to be opportunities for us to listen from different voices and different experiences. So we have a kind of ongoing opportunity that's able to essentially explore race and what does race look like? How can we interact with some of the conversations around the race card project is one table that we'll have. But then also we have some folks that'll be joining us for two separate panels later in the day. And so one panel that will be happening at 1 o'clock. That's the panel of the Mariel boatlift refugees. And so for those little background there, there were about 14,000 refugees that came over from Cuba in 1980, and they actually came to Fort McCoy and then dispersed to the local area from there. And so this panel We'll have four folks, four men who arrived in 1980 with those Cuban refugees, and they'll be able to tell their stories, their experiences about living here in the U.S. for 40 years in a very different environment, mostly in the La Crosse and surrounding areas, and how that compares to the first 20 or so years of their life right before coming here. So that'll be a really powerful piece. But then there's actually going to be an accompanying photo exhibit with that displayed in our Fine Arts Center building and our Nursing Center building that will kind of help depict the boat lift and some of the narrative that accompanies the stories that we'll hear. So another panel that we're really looking forward to highlighting it too is the Enduring Families Project panel. And that's going to be all virtual from 3:30 to 4:30. And that's going to be hosted with Enduring Families Project, sponsored by La Crosse Historical Society here. And so they host numerous opportunities and have really been instrumental in telling the stories of African-American residents from La Crosse and historical experiences, historical figures, and the impact that they've made locally, and kind of how their legacies continue here in the area. So we'll have four panelists for that. We're actually going to screen a couple short films that really dive into George Taylor and George Pogue, two pretty prominent African-American La Crosse residents from the late 1800s there. And so we're going to have, as part of the panel, the reenactors for both of those people, both of those figures, as well as the two founders, and right, Denise Christie Moss and Rebecca Moorman will be joining us for that panel as well. So we'll screen those two films and then be able to hear directly from the folks involved with this powerful project there. The last kind of piece that's also ongoing throughout the morning there, or the afternoon there, is that we're building in the Hear Hear walking tours. And so we're gonna have groups leave and go through the tour of the Voices of La Crosse, racial injustice. It was, I believe, part of one of the Juneteenth celebrations, but a tour of the Black experiences downtown La Crosse, and we'll be able to walk that and hear the stories and connect back to the messages of how does that apply to today's climate? How does that apply to moving these messages beyond just Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and how can we live that out throughout the rest of our community experience there. And I definitely forgot to mention one of the most important parts is lunch too, but we're building in some authentic Cuban food for lunch for folks that are able. There's some payment options, but that's one that we'll have a chance to indulge in some deliciousness and then hear from the panel immediately after that.
I was going to say that coincides nicely with the Cuban panel that you've been talking about.
Yeah. It's I'm really excited. It's going to be a special day. And I mean, this is year one, right? And so this could grow into some pretty meaningful, powerful community impact there. And that's just those are just the options that we have, you know, set times for. There's a whole host of on your own engagement opportunities with resources, again, highlighting some local connections here in the La Crosse area, highlighting some resources to celebrate people of color, celebrate Black History Month, celebrate Black businesses in the La Crosse area, really trying to live out these values Dr. King challenged us to do in an authentic way there. So
the events that you mentioned, some of them you specifically mentioned being online. There are other things that you mentioned taking place on campus. Are there opportunities for the public to join you on campus for these discussions, or is it all happening online?
Most of it is all happening online. I think the things that are happening in person are more for Viterbo students and employees at this point, thinking of the service projects, just because we know that those folks are right also following the Viterbo COVID safety guidelines and those things that we have to put in place this year, hopefully not many years after this. I think the bulk of what the community could participate in would be the virtual panels, and then definitely the celebration at night, the community celebration at 7.
And how do people see those events, especially the panels? I know the evening event is going to be on Viterbo's Facebook page streamed. Is that where the other events are going to be as well?
We're actually going to post the Zoom links right on our MLK Day Service Learning Celebration website there. And so we're going to do that the morning of, and we'll have some folks monitoring to make sure we don't get any uninvited guests on our Zoom bombers, right? We'll post that there. So everything is in one place for folks that are looking to engage with the day on your own virtually, in person. But
Dr. Kite, as you're looking back at, over the history of these events, Martin Luther King community celebration has gone on for a while, and adding now some of these daytime learning opportunities and everything, how have you seen this event grow over the years, and why do you think it's so important for a community like La Crosse, with the history that La Crosse has and the racial makeup that La Crosse has, to honor Dr. King?
Well, let me start with the first part of that question first, how it's grown. This is the event itself has been going on for a long time in our community. And there's a committee that is made up of different people representing a variety of organizations that have worked really diligently to host this event every year, thinking that it's important for our community to honor Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's legacy. And for a number of years, it was hosted at English Lutheran Church, and then the event grew larger. And one of the reasons we're hosting it at Viterbo is, first of all, is that our classes were usually in session beginning on that Monday in January. And so we have everybody available, including our students, and then we can use our Fine Arts Center for it. And I would say for the last 10 years or so, we've been either filling or coming close to filling that 1,200 seat auditorium with community members. And it has become a very public and I think a significant event. And so that goes into the second part. Why is it important for communities like ours? I think it's important for every community. You have to publicly recognize what you wish to be. And if we wish to be a community, first of all, that celebrates everybody and the contribution of everybody in our community, we have to recognize that publicly. We have to hold events like this. And secondly, if we want our interaction to be committed both to justice, to serious justice, which requires real reform of the way in which we interact with one another and the ways in which our laws and our systems, our policies and so forth. But we also want to do it in a way which recognizes the importance of nonviolence, that we're gonna make these changes through persuasion and not coercion. Then we have to recognize Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and we have to celebrate his legacy. And we have a lot to learn from that. I think both the importance he placed on justice and the way in which he went about it are both really important for us to continue to learn from.
That's Dr. Richard Kite of Viterbo University. He's the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership. Also heard in this segment from Colin Burns-Gilbert from Viterbo University, the director of Orientation and Engagement. The event they're talking about, among many other events throughout the day, but all culminating in the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration that's coming up on Monday at 7 p.m., and it'll be available online through Viterbo's Facebook page, and we'll find out more information about that as the day goes on. Coming up, we'll talk to Amanda Goodenough, who is an award recipient on the evening and the director of campus climate at UWL. That's coming up next here on Newsmakers. If you'd like to find out more about our program, you can always reach us on our website. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. Our show continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you very much for joining us. We're talking about the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration going on Monday in La Crosse. It's an annual event that not only honors Dr. King and his legacy, but also encourages people to become a part of the solution, so to speak, by engaging in acts of service and education as well. We're joined by a panel of guests that includes Amanda Goodenough from UWL, Dr. Rick Kite from Viterbo, Colin Burns-Gilbert from Viterbo, and we're continuing our conversation here on Newsmakers today. Amanda, let me circle over to you. You're the director of campus climate at UWL, and you're also this year's recipient of the Martin Luther King Leadership Award. First of all, welcome to Newsmakers and congratulations on the award. That's amazing.
Thank you so much. Yes, it's been overwhelming and humbling. But I've been trying to feel worthy and just embrace it because it's really validating for the work that I do.
Speaking of the work that you do, tell people what the Campus Climate Office does and what your role there is.
Sure. So the Resource and Resource Center, Research and Resource Center for Campus Climate, or Campus Climate for short, we're entrusted to center historically marginalized communities. We liberate the learner and we disrupt inequitable systems to advance things like social justice and racial equity in our collective circles of influence or spheres of influence. And some of the ways we carry that out is through educating the UWL campus and the greater community on contemporary equity and social justice issues, working toward improving retention of historically marginalized communities at UWL. We ensure an accessible and supportive outlet for those who are impacted by things like hate and bias and other forms of discrimination. And then we do a lot with just trying to promote understanding of things like power and positionality through social identity development, through different kinds of programs where we empower social justice activism.
I think people hear words like social justice and equity and those kinds of things talked about. But when people stop and think about how to apply this kind of language to our lives, I think that's where sometimes there might be a little bit of an understanding gap between people who have experiences that expose them to inequality and racism more versus people who might not have those same experiences. So how can somebody be more aware of the inequality around them and use that to create greater equity around their sphere of influence?
It can seem daunting, but I think that there's like very tangible and simple and everyday things that we can do. I always say, you know, there's so much, you know, community work that is important, but we can't do the community work without the inner work, and vice versa. And so I always am an advocate for starting with ourselves and just understanding things like the social identities that we all hold and how they inform the way that we show up and interact with others and the way we form opinions. And when I say social identities, I'm talking about identities that we are more or less born into, or things that we might not necessarily be able to change about ourselves, or might be a matter of circumstance, or sometimes these are identities that are have like legal protections around them because of the history of our country. And so things like race are, and everybody has a race, you know, and gender, everyone has a gender identity and expression, and sexual orientation, and you know, age, ability, status, all of these things, and just really exploring and examining, sometimes interrogating, you know, like what identities we hold and how we can, you know, learn more about those, because sometimes what we find is that we've been socialized to create, you know, biases or stereotypes around these things. And so starting with ourselves and figuring out how we can be better human beings for each other is a great first step. But there's all sorts of things, from just, you know, diversifying the books that we read, to the media we consume, to being more critically, you know, more critical thinkers around the messages that we're consuming, to intentionally connecting with people who might have differing, you know, viewpoints or identities or experiences from us.
What is it that made you interested in chasing this kind of career and involving yourself professionally in this kinds of thing?
You know, I think that there are probably many, many things that I could point to, but it's hard not to focus on some of my earliest memories of understanding what race was, or learning what race was, and unfortunately learning that through the experiences of racism. And I guess to try to be succinct, I identify as a mixed multiracial woman of color who holds African-American and Black identities and Mexican identities and Native identities. And when I was in second grade, we moved to a community, a town called Mukwonago, and that community was just not ready for us as a very white community. And they made it very well known that they didn't want my Black and brown family to move there. And so, you know, that was my introduction to race and racism and just seeing, you know, how we were treated, which my parents tried to protect us from a lot of what was happening, but they, you know, they couldn't come to school with us. And so we had to experience things that no one should have to experience. And then, you know, we would go home and our parents would have a lot of explaining to do. And so, you know, this was a constant conversation in our household because it had to be. And, you know, I don't know that I even thought about it in that way during those formative years, but especially after I left that community and just learned more about some of the things I talked about earlier, you know, my identities and other people's identities and how we're showing up in the world. I started to do a lot more reflection and I started questioning things. And I had some stories, but there were a lot of holes in my stories. And so I asked my parents a lot of questions so that I could fill those holes in my stories. And I learned all sorts of things that I didn't know as far as how horribly we were treated just because of who we were from everything from pipe bombs in our mailbox to receiving death threats to learning. I think I was in undergrad in college when I learned that my family had sued the town of Maquonago for racial discrimination. And so, I mean, you know, this, it's not all of my story, but it is certainly a huge piece of my story. And it absolutely informs the work that I do. I always say it's not just a profession. It's actually quite personal. And I use that and I see how, you know, the oppression of racism is connected to all other oppressions. And I just believe that no one should have to experience what we experienced.
That's Amanda Goodenough. She will be the recipient of the Martin Luther King Leadership Award at this year's Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration. She is the director of Campus Climate at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. Also with us today, Colin Burns-Gilbert of Viterbo University and Dr. Richard Kite of Viterbo University. Dr. Kite, as an ethics and leadership professor and a person who is involved in helping people understand a lot of these issues, how can somebody who might not consider themselves to be in a position of leadership and yet who sees inequity around in society, maybe in family, maybe in work, maybe in other situations, how can a person exercise positive leadership in those areas where they might not think they have very much influence?
Well, as Martin Luther King said, we can all be leaders because we can all serve. And wherever we have an opportunity to help others, and we don't have to have positions of power to help others. It's an attitude of the heart. And it requires attention and some diligence and some effort, but we all have those opportunities. And the wonderful thing is when you do that, when you address a genuine need, you can have tremendous influence, both directly in the person that you assist, but also in the observers. And these might be people that don't even see what you're doing, but you inspire them to act likewise. And this is the way in which goodness always elevates. And it is easy to forget how influential that can be, but we've all had experiences of that ourselves where we've just observed somebody doing something genuinely good or heartfelt out of love or concern or compassion. And it inspires us to be a better person in our relationships. And so we should never underestimate our ability to exercise leadership, whether we're in a position of power or not.
Dr. Richard Kite of Viterbo University has been speaking just now. Also, Amanda Goodenough of UWL and Colin Burns-Gilbert of Viterbo University. The events we've been talking about, by the way, the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration going on 7 o'clock Monday evening, but also the panel discussions that Colin mentioned earlier and that we'll go over again in our last segment here on the show. All that information is available on Viterbo's website, which is viterbo.edu. That's viterbo.edu. You can find more information about our program on our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. It's easy to find previous episodes. You can stream them on demand. If podcasting is more your thing, you can find us in most of your favorite podcasting apps. Just open your favorite platform, search for Newsmakers, and hit subscribe. Our conversation continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. We're talking about Martin Luther King Day and the community celebration coming up in La Crosse on Monday. And the main celebration is at 7 p.m. It will be available on the Viterbo University Facebook page. There are lots of other events that are going to be available at viterbo.edu as well. Joining us talking about these events has been Colin Burns-Gilbert, the Director of Orientation and Engagement at Viterbo University, Dr. Rick Kite, the Director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo, and Amanda Goodenough, the Director of Campus Climate at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, and also the recipient of this year's Martin Luther King Leadership Award. So certainly, Amanda, we thank you for your leadership in these areas, and congratulations on the award. Very exciting. Let's get to Colin. You were giving us a rundown of kind of the events. So why don't we talk about the discussions that are available for the public and how they can participate in either the two panel discussions or the evening festivities?
So I think the easiest way is just go to our website. You'll be able to get there from the Viterbo homepage there. But the first panel will start at 1, and we'll have the Zoom link posted that morning. So they'll be there to access wherever you are. And then the 3:30 panel will be our Enduring Families Project. And so that'll be, again, Zoom link posted in that dropdown. If you visit the website, each kind of area or each event has a dropdown with more information, some hyperlinks to kind of explore a little bit. And so that will be, again, posted there that morning. And so you're welcome to join and screen some of the videos that really highlight George Taylor and George Pogue and the incredible work that Enduring Families Project is doing in our community, and then be able to Q&A and ask questions with the reenactors and the founders of that project.
So I'm going to pick on you first, Colin. I posed a question to everybody ahead of time and just wanted to get a little bit of reflection. What is it that you're looking forward to engaging in, or what practice are you most looking forward to as you keep Martin Luther King Day this year?
I'm biased, but the part that resonates the most with me, I think, is that the service components, building those relationships with some of our nonprofits that are on the front lines of serving our community's most vulnerable is a powerful place to be, and the learning and growth and relationships that can start from there is the sky's the limit. And sometimes it starts with a day like this for students or employees to, you know, get your toes in the water, and it becomes a, you know, lifelong passion, and anything can happen.
Dr. Kite, as you think of Martin Luther King Day this year and sort of your personal involvement with it, what is it that you're looking forward to as you reflect on the holiday?
Well, this year is going to be so much different because I usually, you know, I get to sit in the audience and kind of watch this event and watch it from the perspective of everybody else in the community. And this year, this, because we're partnering with Dr. William Barber's organizations, this is being live streamed all over the world. And so here we'll have the world watching the La Crosse community celebration of Martin Luther King Jr. And yet what's so important is it's still in some ways, it's a local celebration. And so this is the sort of thing that I love about it. There would be somewhere in that audience watching on Facebook, say a 12 or 13 year old girl who watches the award ceremony and hears about Amanda Goodenough, what she's done in her life. And she will think to herself, I want to be just like her when I grow up. And that's the beauty of this kind of event, is that you're able to have a kind of influence through inspiration that is immeasurable on the day, but we know it bears fruit in the long run.
Indeed so. Speaking of Amanda Goodenough, we come to you next, Amanda. So what, as you reflect on the Martin Luther King holiday this year, What's going through your mind? What are you personally looking forward to either being involved in or reflecting on this year?
I think the day itself, I'm really excited to just come together, the coming together, especially after a year where I think a lot of us have felt, really apart from each other and, lonely or alone. And even though we won't be physically together still, just knowing that we're having this shared experience, that centers so much love, and things like justice and equity, which I feel like is love in action, is going to be really special. I've already received so much love, and it's absolutely been filling my cup. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm also, as I think about that day and beyond, this is maybe a little bit of cautious optimism, but I'm at some point looking to that day as, I hope eventually a pivot to a time where, on a personal level, and maybe for anyone else who can relate, a time where we might start moving toward just being able to breathe easier again. I'm not talking about just on that day, but at some point after that day, it might be days or weeks or months, but I just feel like I've been holding my breath for so many years, and seeing all that has happened over the last year, which isn't new necessarily, but I think there's been a new, racial reckoning and awakening around it. I'm just hopeful that maybe, some of the conversations and some of this work will move from being like stuck in the, like, how do we do this? And really center the why we need to, and just, figure it out. And also when the last thing I'll say, and I'm always looking for wisdom in others. So I wanted to amplify someone else's, quote, when I think about Martin Luther King Jr., I think, there is so much emphasis on service. And I absolutely, agree with that and appreciate that and want us to remember that. But I also think that it's more than service. And so, Clint Smith said, if you're doing an MLK Day service project, consider bringing a King level analysis to it. For example, don't just serve lunch at a soup kitchen, interrogate why we allow millions of people to live in poverty in the first place. And so that's my hope, is that we're, at some point, maybe this holiday can be a pivot for us to dig deeper and to do more and to act more boldly and courageously in the fight for equity and justice.
That's Amanda Goodenough. She is this year's recipient of the Martin Luther King Leadership Award at the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration. Amanda, thank you very much for your perspective today and for sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'll mention the other award recipients on the evening will be Chaya Davis, who's the Linda Blackman Lowry Youth Leadership Award recipient. She's a student at Logan High School, so congratulations there. And then you might remember a conversation we had some months ago on Newsmakers with Dodie Whitaker, who talked about not only her involvement in the Enduring Families Project, which we mentioned earlier today, but also she talked about her father, the Reverend Dr. Calvin S. Morris. Dr. Morris will be the recipient of sort of a lifetime honor at the awards ceremony as well. And the Reverend Dr. Morris, of course, we talked about previously, marched with Dr. King, was involved with Reverend Jesse Jackson as part of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and much more. So you can learn about these people and their efforts at the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration Monday, January 18th at 7 p.m. On Viterbo University's Facebook page. We've been speaking today also with Colin Burns-Gilbert of Viterbo University about some of the other events going on throughout the day, which you can find information about at viterbo.edu. And Colin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely. And Dr. Richard Kite, who is the D.B. Reinhardt, the director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo, and has shared his expertise with us today as well. Dr. Kite, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be here.
There are a couple of opportunities each week to hear Newsmakers. Our show originates at 10 a.m. on Fridays on WHLA on the Ideas Network 90.3. We repeat 6 p.m. on Fridays on WLSU in La Crosse, which is 88.9, and then we're up early 5 a.m. on Saturday mornings, also at 88.9 WLSU. For the rest of our La Crosse staff, including Dawn Jewell and John Davis, I'm Ezra Wall, wishing you a very good week, and please join us next time for the next Newsmakers here on Wisconsin Public Radio.